Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery. With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBW 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren. We've got Mr. Dave Martino.
I'm here.
You're here, back from karate. Doing? There you go.
Yes.
Yeah. Kung Kung Fu-y.
That's right.
You know,
non-classical Kung Fu. That's what it is.
Well, is that what it is?
Yeah. Yeah, Jeet Kune Do. Bruce Lee's Jeet Kune Do concepts.
You're not allowed to swear on it.
And Filipino Kali.
Is that like food?
No.
It's not like a pizza or anything like that.
It's like getting hit with sticks all night.
That's kind of get aroused here.
Oh, wow. Well, you know,
I like being hit by sticks a little bit. Yeah. It's that into that beating thing, you know. Thing, you know, crazy. I guess I am. Well, the week continues. Now, today we keep on going, and today we've got an author. His newest book is called All Who Wonder, and it's Mr. Joe Clifford. So thank you for being here, Joe.
Thanks for having me. It's always fun to do this.
Yeah. Well, we haven't had you yet. But
well, I mean, talking crap, meet the air, and all those fancy grad school words that I paid $200,000 to learn and not make any money at. It's fun to do that.
Well, yeah. So let's talk about you. So how did you get into this world of writing? You've written several books. So what exactly led you into this world?
Besides the mental illness? I think, you know, do we seek out our careers? Do they seek out us out? I'm, you know, as my former professor, Tom Hazuka, a brilliant writer in his own right, once said, I'm not cut out for the 9-to-5. And I learned that very early on. I'm just not wired to do 9-to-5. I can't. And I know a lot of people are like, going to listen to this being like, I don't want to do it either. It's not like, I don't want to. It's, you know, within a week I'll be fired. I just don't have the temperament to listen. I don't have the bandwidth to follow orders or be, you know, I just can't do it. It's just not who I am. So you have to find a way to kind of exist outside of that societal construct, which is pretty much how most of the world runs. As an artist, you know, there's no real direct path to being an artist. My friend, Judge Peter Bush, who I teach up with at a book passage, said that about being a judge. And I love it because it's really true. You sort of stumble into it. You know, I'm not sure at 8 years old you can map out a path to be an artist. I mean, I guess you can. I guess Bret Easton Ellis wrote his first book when he was 19. And I know Franz Nicolay, who's a musician, who I interviewed a while ago, said his plan was always to be a musician, and he just, you know, started studying and just made that happen. Most of the artists I know sort of just find their way into it. Usually it's a series of failed enterprises, realizing what you can't do, realizing you have a creative streak and something to say and a need, and that's paramount, is the need to say it. And that's all that's really in your control. After that, you know, the publishing and success and who's going to read your book. You know, those are things you have to kind of relinquish the control over, which is a strange dichotomy, right? We're controlling our environs and we're creating these worlds, and we are quite literally gods of these creations. And then you have to step back and see how the world receives it. So yeah, I ended up going, you know, a crooked road down a one-way street, and I ended up here.
Well, so what kind of writer would you consider yourself? Like, how would you, if someone says, met you and said, what do you write? What would you say to them?
Well, like a kid who makes his own nickname, I feel bad saying this, but I always wanted to be called a rock and roll writer. I started out as a musician. I have a band, The Wandering Jews. We're still recording. We're still, Franz Nicolai, who I just mentioned, actually played keyboards on the last record. A heart, if I had to pick the one writer more instrumental than any other writer, you know, including all the novelists, it would be Bruce Springsteen. I was raised on Springsteen up in the East Coast. Springsteen could consolidate an entire book down to two lines. You know, remember all the movies Terry we'd go and see, trying to learn how to walk like the heroes we thought we'd someday be, and after all this time to find we're just like all the rest. I mean, I write an entire book, taking 300 pages to write that. So I've always tried to infuse that spirit of rock and roll into my books. I think being a musician also is granting me a certain musicality. There's a cadence to the language, cadence to the, you know, the syntax, the rhythm, there's beats, there's an internal beats. You know, then you got that fun stuff like alliteration and allusion and symbionts. But you also have to, you know, at the heart, it's a story. I mean, you're telling a story, and people, all that other stuff is the window dressing that we as writers like to do. We're telling a story, and the story we're telling, it's the same story I was telling when I was playing rock and roll. It's the same story I told when I was painting, and it's the same story I tell now as a writer. And that's, you know, about the marginalized, the disenfranchised, the voices for the voiceless. You know, I spent 10 years as a homeless heroin addict in the 90s, and it was a vital, imperative experience for me, because I was somebody who came from a very nice upper middle class town where everyone looked the same and thought the same and believed the same. And if you were different, that was your problem. And I needed that experience to learn empathy. Empathy has to be taught, right? I mean, empathy has to be experienced. We can teach sympathy, but empathy you have to experience. And so that experience of living, you know, going from having, you know, a roof over my head and parents who paid for things to all of a sudden being, you know, eating out of a dumpster and sleeping under a bridge, taught me one of life's most valuable lessons. You know, be kind and try to understand that everybody's fighting a battle you know nothing about. That's a struggle I fight daily, because I also still at heart I have that you know, that East Coast kind of cynicism and grittiness and sort of I don't know what you'd call it. And there's definitely a difference between the East and the West coasts. You know, that's the battle that I've always got going on inside me, part Bill Burr and part, you know, I want to say shaman. But
Bruce Springsteen, so he's a singer? No, just kidding. did you hear his interview on Howard Stern?
Everyone asked me that, you know, and I haven't gone, and I missed it the first time, and I haven't gone back, and I have this weird thing where it's if I miss something the first time, I'm reluctant to go back because I feel like I missed the moment, and I know I should, because everyone keeps telling me how fantastic it is, and I'm sure I'll get around to it. I'm mostly just kicking myself for missing it, you know, live. There's no excuse for me to have missed it. He's just
to your room.
Yeah. Yeah, to your room.
Bad, yeah. Bad boy.
Now, we'll be listening to East Street Radio on Sirius as I bring the boys to school, and I must stop the middle of Springsteen songs. I'm like, boys, just listen to the story. The stories he tells, especially in the segues of growing up, or, you know, the start of Independence Day, the river, certainly. You know, it's as good a storyteller he gets. He can do a turn of phrase, and he can do the twist and the end. And God, I mean, yeah, just, and I was fortunate enough a few years ago to get to do an anthology based on his songs. We actually got permission from Bruce. John Lando was CC'd on the correspondence, which was pretty awesome. We got Dennis Lehane, who went to FIU, where I graduated, who was generous enough to donate a story, and you know, the proceeds went to the Bob Woodruff Foundation, you know, to help veterans. And that was another highlight of my career, to just, you know, take Springsteen lyrics and Springsteen songs and make a book out of it and get some wonderful, wonderful writers to contribute to that. So,
what do you find the difference between when you're writing a song, let's say, and the lyrics and how you write a song compared to how you write a book? Of course, the.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Book has a lot more to it, and there's more detail and stuff. But what's the biggest difference for you?
It's going to sound weird. Being a writer, it should sound like words would be paramount to a song. But the cool thing about rock and roll is you can get away with rhyming car and bar. Words more often than not get in the way of a song. So the words and the music is a very symbiotic relationship. You want to have the best lyrics possible. You know, I think the best lyricist in rock is probably Roger Waters, probably one of the worst human beings around, but one of the best lyricists, certainly for an angry 16-year-old boy, which is when the Wall came out, for me at least. But, you know, you also, you know, look at probably his best written record in terms of lyrics is The Dark Side of the Moon. And those are very simple words. They're not overly convoluted. They're not overly complex. They're simple concepts. And there, you know, you want to, all right, this is probably sounds a little pretentious, but you go back to the preface to the lyrical ballads, and William Wordsworth's The Language Really Used by Men. And I think you can get away with that more in rock and roll. You can kind of be the replacement and say, I'm skipping school, because when they were writing those songs, they were literally skipping school. And I think that comes across to an audience, whereas you get, you know, and some more pretentious lyrics, you know, you're kind of, not to bash on Neil Peart, who's, you know, died and was a great drummer, but probably one of my least favorite lyricists, just because he was so overwrought and it was so, you know, overwritten and kind of slogged down, and some slogging down music. But yeah, anyway, so I think, yeah, you can simplify more with lyrics. And with books, you know, you have 300 words. All you have is the words. You don't have any music, boy, the message. So you can't have that catchy beat, you know, can I dance to it? You got the words, and the words can't hide. Music gives you a little bit of, a little bit of cloaking subterfuge, I guess.
All who wonder. So what's the premise of this book?
Well, the premise is a 20-year-old girl, Brooke Mulcahy, who comes from a small town in Massachusetts, doesn't get along with her father, has a new baby brother, a half-brother who's introduced when her estranged mother comes back into town saying she's dying, and to please take care of her new son. And the new son, Robert, Bobby, and Brooke don't get along, and they have a very short 4-year relationship before Brooke goes missing and her body's never found. It's many years later, 25 years later, I think. And Robert is now Bobby. He's a professor of civil engineering at a prestigious university. He's receiving an award. But before he receives the award, he gets a visit from a young lady who claims to be his missing half-sister Brooke's daughter, born 9 months after she disappeared. And that's the premise of the book, and that's how the book starts. Of course, it gets weirder and wilder. Most of my books are in the cold New England. And once in a while, I'll break out and go down to Southern California and go with my next book, I'm Off the Flame. But I like the cold, and I like the mountains, and I like the Northeast. I grew up there, and you know, it's so fundamental to who I am. It also speaks to, I think, you know, what I see my characters going through, where you have this sort of hard scrabble existence, you know, everything in the cold is, you know, you have to scrounge for sustenance, you have to dig for food, you have to sort of layer up to just go outside. I mean, you know, the wind hurts your face. Yeah. And there's something about that element that appeals to me when writing.
Yeah, everyone likes to be hurt. Yeah, I mean, I long for it, but... So now your characters, how would you describe your characters, or your relationship with your characters, I should say, because we should find out really how you come to have these characters and how you interact with them.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, perception versus reality. How I would describe my characters versus how they are received. I probably received the word in reviews, the phrase unlikable more than any other writer. And I guess maybe they are unlikable. I was fortunate enough to interview Russell Banks a while back when I was at FIU, and he described his characters as wounded. And I love that. And if you haven't read Affliction, which is, you know, the greatest cold mountain book ever written, and God, if I could, you know, you just, if you haven't read Affliction, don't forget my books. Put down everything and read Affliction. It is just masterful. But I love that, wounded. And most of the people I know are wounded. And it's maybe because I came from where I came from in the 90s, and the people I met, you know, it's very difficult when you meet a drug addict who's a father, right? And you say that to somebody and they're like, well, that's obviously a terrible father. But I knew these people, and these fathers and mothers who were, yes, addicted to drugs and doing bad things, and they were not applauding their lifestyle, but they still loved their kids. And that's a really hard concept for people who haven't lived that way to understand, because you hear drug abuse and you think immediately parental abuse and take those kids out of there. And I'm not saying the kids shouldn't be out of there. I'm not saying they should be in there. I'm just saying I knew these fathers and I knew these mothers, and they still loved their kids. They were wounded, flawed, deeply damaged people, but they loved their kids the same way I love mine. And to see that, you know, that's the story I want to tell, or the story of the wounded who are doing the best they can with what they got. And maybe it's not a good enough effort for most, but it's the best they can do.
How do you get readers to warm up to flawed characters? Do you have a, like a technique to kind of get them to understand the better side of these people that you're creating?
Yeah, I mean, you start with your ordinary world. You start with showing them in their environment, and you show them with their favorable characteristics and doing kind things. There is I've come to accept a certain faction of readership. And this isn't to knock anybody. It's just a matter of taste, but there are some people who simply do not like a book unless you have likable characters. And there's a good percentage of people, just like a good percentage of people who won't read a book that's got swearing. They don't like sexual content. They don't like this. They don't like that. And that's their right. I mean, we live in, this is a consumer society. The market will stand what the market can bear. I could change some of that. When I was publishing with Ocean View, Bob and Pat Gusson were terrific people, lovable publishers, and I loved working with them. But their one constant complaint was like, Joe, you got to make these people more likable. And the reason we stopped working together was like, that's not the story I'm telling. I mean, I'm not telling, this isn't, I'm not Lee Child. I mean, I'm not Lee Child because I can't write as well as Lee Child. But, these guys aren't Jack Reacher. They're not coming to town to save the day. They're trying to, some people wake up, I think, and I don't know, I'm taking this on hearsay, but they wake up and they're like, hey, great, another day, man. I'm not one of those people. I wake up and my first thought is, you got to be kidding me. I'm still here. I got to do this again? And within seconds, the Pomeranian's barking and somebody's like, the dog crapped in the house and the kids are like, can you give me my cereal? My wife's like, I need my coffee. I got to go. And my anxiety, I have a crippling, I have really bad anxiety disorder. But within, 4 minutes of being awake, my heart rate's at 140. And this is every day. And I don't know how, there's the Bob Dylan line. I don't know how it all got started. I don't know what they're doing with their lives. I don't understand how most people live their life. I do understand how a small faction, a small percentage of people like myself, people who remind me of me, I understand their plight. I understand that plight very well, and that's the story I tell. That plight, unfortunately, does not have a very large pocketbook. They are not the most generous benefactors, and it does not for a lucrative career make, but it's the story I'm interested in telling. I'm not interested in telling a story about, the two people who met each other and everything was great and that was fantastic. I'm not interested in writing a cozy fiction with a cat who solves mysteries by mistake. I'm not interested in writing, I'm just not interested in that. I'll do some things for money. I'll do a lot of things for money, and I'll bend and capitulate, and I'll try to write to the market the best I can. But there is a line that you can't cross because you're just, at that point, you're disingenuous. You're not being true to who you are, and there's a lot of things. But, I'm not full of
shit. How dare you?
That's the one thing I'm not, and I can't do it. So I got to tell the story that's true to me and the story that, resonates for me. And
yeah. Of course, you'll do porn, but you won't be prosy.
Yeah,
there's standards here. I understand that.
And that statement is so much so true. It really is, and it's weird, right? Like, it's like in my mind, that statement makes perfect sense, right?
Yeah. It does for me.
Yeah, actually, I'll do porn, but not cozy.
Porn makes sense. Cozies don't.
Yeah.
Cozies aren't real. I know what you're saying. Because a lot of times we'll have cozy authors. We've done that. And we'll have ones that won't touch sex or violence or swearing, and yet they'll have a murder mystery. And it's just, it doesn't seem real.
Yeah, and some of these are great, great writers. I mean, I know so many cozy writers who are fantastic writers.
Oh, yeah.
It's just not what I do,
Yeah. Yeah. And plus, I always feel there's something missing. If I'm reading a story, or even if I'm watching a story and there's a murder mystery and stuff, it's not like I need to have, 20 minutes of the blood draining out of the bodies. It's just about got to have some realism. So people are real. They do have sex. They do swear. They do make mistakes.
Yeah. And it's what you're comfortable, as a writer, if I have a sexual assault in my book, I don't describe it. I can't, because I can't. I mean, that's just not something I'm comfortable doing. I'm not comfortable putting that on the page. But there are sexual assaults. There are murders. There are, you have to add that level of verisimilitude to make the scene, feel real. And when you get criticisms like, I like this book, but, the cops swear too much. It's like, I'm sorry, cops don't go around going, oh, golly, gosh, gee, gosh darn it. It's, there's another dang damn body. That's not how they talk. That's not how we talk in the real world. That's not how people talk. So, you know, you get right through your characters, and the characters I write about are, they tend to be mostly, not always, but, you know, all who want is an outlier, but they tend to be not college educated, most of them. And they tend to talk a lot like my brother, who was not college educated, no longer with us, but I base a lot of characters sort of on him, because he was sort of this everyman to me who was just a little angrier than he should have been. Coming from me, that's saying a lot. But didn't quite understand why he was so angry. I'd like to believe one of the things that education, now that everybody has to get a college education, or you know, some of the smartest people I know, don't have, you know, one, and I'd put them against anybody. But, one thing, you know, college does do is it helps you with that empathy experience, and it, you know, there's the line in Catcher in the Rye, which is what I named my son Holden, which I was supposed to say, but I named him after that book. It's my favorite book ever. But there's a line later on in the book where Mr. Antonelli is telling him, like, basically the same thing. Like, you don't have to be a college, but it tends to be the ones who go to college tend to leave the records, you know, to be read at a later date, or, you know, and I'm paraphrasing. I just find the people who haven't quite gotten there and can't quite express that to be a little more interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, at the end, and the story is, people say that as a writer and writers, your characters, each of them have some of you in them. Right. Each character you write will have a piece of you, maybe small or maybe large. Which of these characters in this book has the most of you?
Well, you know, this, I'd like to believe this is a more original creation. And if you read the book, you'd be like, I can see why you don't be attached to either of these people. You know, all of them have a little bit of me, and I'll leave it to the reader to decide which parts are me, and please pick the better parts. The character that I get most tied with is Jay Porter, the Jay Porter series. And Jay very much is me, although I am not Jay. One of the more sobering moments of my life was reading. I used to record, mentally record fights that happened to my wife, because I'm a writer. And I decided to put one of these fights on the page between Jay and his wife. And when I wrote the scene out, I wrote exactly the way the fight happened. And I waited for everybody to be like, of course he's right. And I got so many comments like, God, that guy's a jerk. it was like, all right, well, maybe we got to rethink things. But yeah, I understand the frustration of life not quite going your way. There's a line from going back to rock and roll, one of my favorite lines in any song ever from Paul Westerberg, everything you dream of is right in front of you. And it's from a song Unsatisfied. It's great, great song, and Gene Arnold has this great anecdote about it, if you get a chance to read it, the Rock Critic, where he's shouting the rest of that lyric across the snowy highway, liberty is a lie. But I love that. Everything you dream is right in front of you, and I think that's true for most people. We see what we want, we know what we want, we can almost touch it, almost taste it, almost feel it, and right when you get to it, your transmission blows, and that goes your $900. And it's the human condition, and it's how we're still going as a society with all the frustrations and failures and letdowns fascinates me. And again, this is a mindset, because there are plenty of people out there who are like, what do you mean? I'm happy just to see the birds flying. And I'm like, well, that's great. We're not going to have lunch together. I mean, like, I have nothing to say to you. Like, those are the people that's not of interest to me. I'm interested in the losers, you know, the down and outs, the failures, the downtrodden, the depressed, the more. But those who have a sense of humor about it, because you want to at least be entertaining. If you're going to be depressing, at least make someone laugh once in a while. So that's sort of my life philosophy. Right.
Well, when you write a book like this, then, or any of your books, it sounds like you're very involved in it. You put a lot of yourself into it. In a way, you're living through the characters as well. I mean, if you're printing out some of your own experiences, or like the fight.
I have wanted to do at a panel, and I pitched this panel to Boucher Khan, who has made it clear I'm not coming back. But several other conferences. Where method writing, you know, you have method acting, and there's method writing, and you really do, you know, when I was writing the Jay Porter stuff, you know, I quit smoking cigarettes years ago, but when I would write Jay Porter, I'd order these fake cigarettes, and I'd have my little wool beanie, and I'd wear it, and I would grow my beard out, and I'd really try to get into the skin of Jay. Hillary Davidson, a fantastic writer, talks about when she was writing a book and it was raining in her book. She went outside, you know, in sunny New York City with her umbrella. I think you can get so immersed in the characters and in the story that you really do embody their characteristics. And I think that's the only way to tell a story with, you know, to get that, those, you know, the Holy Trinity, the Holy, you know, Latin Trinity of ethos, pathos, and logos, is to get into that skin and, where it is your own, which of course, you know, it carries some dangers. There's a great anecdote about Gillian Flynn having to leave a note upstairs to herself when she was writing Gone Girl, leave the darkness upstairs, because she was going home and taking out Amy Dunn on her husband, which wasn't fair to him, although I would be personally thrilled because Amy Dunn is sort of my dream girl, but that says more about me than I guess it does Gillian Flynn.
Yeah, that's a different story. But so would you, putting so much and living through this book, for however long it takes you to write it, at the end of it, when you look back now, All Who Wonder Is Out, what kind of changes did it make in you, or how has it changed you?
I was surprised by how many people liked it. I really expected this was the book was going to give me the most blowback because of some scenes and some descriptions and the subject matter that's covered. I really thought I was going to catch a lot of flack for this. And most of the response has been overwhelmingly positive, and it speaks to what I really believe is kind of what governs the best crime writing. You know, to have, you know, the darker it gets, you know, you need it to get as dark as possible to have that little bit of hope and light shining through at the end. And I'd like to believe that all my books, you know, as dark as they can be, there's that little hope shining at the end, and that's what we stay alive for. You know, if there was no chance of hope, there'd be no reason to wake up. But there's always a chance today might be the day. There's always a chance today something miraculous, you know, you've never seen before could happen. And I think that's what keeps society going. That's what keeps us humanity, you know, moving. So, and that's definitely true in this book. This book gets probably darker than any other book, but also has, at the very end, a glimmer of hope. And I think that's what's resonating, but, you know, who knows? I mean, it's such a weird thing being a writer or any kind of artist. You write it or create to the best of your ability, and then you put it out there, and your say is done. It's how you know the reader, the viewer, interpreter reacts, and you know that's their right, and that, you know, they're right because they're the judge. And you can say, well, I didn't, you know, wish it this or that, but then you got to do a better job next time. So I'm really happy with the response so far. Both Say My Name and All Who Wander, which came out with the new publishing endeavor, Square Tire Books, have done really, really well. And I owe a great deal to my loyal fan base and readership to come out in droves to support my career.
Well, we'll see if we can change that.
I'm sure I'll say something wrong. I've already said something wrong the last year that got me in a lot of trouble. I'm probably getting in trouble just for even repeating, saying the wrong thing on Reddit. Called back up on Twitter or whatever the hell it's called now. But yeah, I mean, I don't have a filter. I just don't. And you get older. I don't know. I should learn to get one, but I'm almost, you know, 53 now. I'm not.
Oh, I need to. Yeah. That's half the fun.
I mean, you make the 85, you can say just about anything. Yeah, I don't know. And I just always would rather, you know, say it the way it is and say it the way I see it. And somebody's always going to be offended, and I, you know, I'm in San Francisco, I'm as left-leaning as they go, and I'm still managing to upset a liberal every other day, so who knows?
Well, with your characters, I was wondering, and this also pertains to maybe music and lyrics, do you have an internal monologue? Can you hear your characters? Is that how you create your dialogue, or do you do it other ways? Do you have to... speak it out loud. Some writers do that.
I read somewhere that like 50% of people have an internal monologue in their head. I'm like,
yeah.
Doesn't everybody walk around with these nonstop voices in their head?
Yeah, exactly.
And, I mean, my head never quiets down. And the one reason I put off meditation for so long was I thought you had to stop the thinking. And that's not what meditation is. Meditation is just simply staying in the center while the thinking goes around. My head is a constant buzzing. I have to have white noise in my house. I have fans on all over the house. I have white noise machines. I can't have silence because the voices in my That makes me sound like I was just on an antipsychotic, and they took me off because it made me pee my pants. And maybe that is true, but I'm not back on an antipsychotic, and I kind of like the voices. The voices, they help me create, and I'm an artist. That's what I do. And if, you know, the occasional incontinence and, you know, something you have to do with an antipsychotics or, you know, just part of the equation, you know, in the exchange, you get 4 books a year from Joe Clifford. So it seems like a fair trade-off to me.
And you're never lonely.
You're only a couple times. There's enough for me to be like, I don't think I should be taking these pills anymore, Doc. Like, you know, yes, they took away the voices, but kind of a big price.
Well, as long as you're not waking up with blood on your hand or anything like that.
So far, right?
Yeah. You know, shoes and the wife goes missing and all that, you know.
No, it wouldn't be the wife. There's definitely people on that list.
Well, let's name some of those people. No, yeah.
And I won't be back at the Miami Book Fair anytime soon.
Yeah.
It's just what I do.
Yeah. Well, now when you sat down to write this, what comes first? Is the characters and then what they're doing? Do you have the idea, the storyline kind of, and then you...
The premise. I like the idea, the idea was simply a missing woman and then someone coming in claiming to be your daughter. That was kind of the start. And you have that and you go, okay, I can do something with that. That gives me a lot of ideas. And then from there, you know, who's going to be supporting this cast of characters and now there's a half brother. And now I understand, you know, if he came back, the resentment they'd have, you know, build from there. And then, you know, the dad, and very New England, you know, there's something very New England about my stuff. My friend Mike, he won't mind me telling this story, but when he was growing up, he was, living in a town called Fall River. He was driving with his dad, and Mike would have been about 17 or something. And he's driving with his dad and he goes, you know, Dad, I think I'm going to college. His father points to the abandoned factory and says, "Where are you going to college over there?" I just love that. Like, just how much less can you support your child? But there is that weird, it's just a weird New England thing. But you know, here it is, we're 30 years later sharing stories about our awful fathers in grad school. And that one still always made us laugh. You know, "Where are you going to college over there?" So it was a different way of growing up. But there is still some humanity that shows through, like, you know, Brooke's dad, there's a very nice scene where he tries to talk to her. You know, the words aren't coming because he's just not a guy who can express himself verbally like that. But you know, he loves his daughter. And I think, you know, my dad loved me and I'm sure Mike's dad loved him. And I'm watching now my son who's getting older and then watching, it's just, you know, Cat Stevens, right? Fathers and sons, you know, and I know I have to go away and sometimes they come back and it's just this weird, the father becomes a son, the son becomes a father, and you do this cycle over and over and over and over again.
Do you have a subtext? Is there a meaning to this besides the actual story?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, are some sins so egregious that we can never amend them? We can never do enough to right what we've done wrong. And you look at something like, we'll just take current turmoil, whatever, controversy, Louis C.K., right? Louis C.K., very funny guy, did something that was pretty awful. I still think Louis C.K. is really funny. Like, is there anything he can do now to make up for that? And I'm picking one that's sort of, you know, then you get the really, really twisted stuff, like, you know, guys like Harvey Weinstein, he says, no. You know, like, you can't. And then you get to the really, really big monsters in the world. The ones who start world wars are like, no, hell no, there's nothing they can do. But there is there a line where a sin is pretty bad? It's bad, but it's not so bad that their entire existence is negated. And so that what this book is, that line. And I was trying to find that line and find out, if that line gets crossed and if it gets crossed by other people, and can we ever come back, and can we ever, or there's some things we just do that we have to live with, and that's it. That's it. There's no walking away, and you just got to live with it. And, you know, we are, you know, like Walt Whitman said, right? We contain multitudes. We're contradictions. We are large. There's very few people, I think, out there who would want every secret and every rotten thing they've ever said or done made public. You know, there are also a lot of these same people standing there, you know, waving their fingers and clutching their pearls. And so, you know, there's that component to it. So that's the story I was interested in telling. And certainly, you know, you're not going to find much more clutch, you know, pro-clutching in, you know, with Salem Witchland over there in New England. But yeah, that's what I want to do. That's what I want to do.
I don't have any pearls.
Yeah, I hopped online.
Wow. So listen, okay. So let's talk about, where people can find you, where people can find the book and all that stuff. Like, are you doing social media, website?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook. That's where I seem to be like the most. Facebook. I just got banned from Instagram this morning. For all the things I said, I mean, it was such an innocuous comment. I made a comment that I couldn't golf at St. Andrews because if I sliced, you know, if I hit on the 18th hole, I'd kill someone. Because it's so close to the road. And they were like, that's not acceptable. I'm like, all the things I've said, that's what's getting me banned.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've been banned from all the major social media platforms. But Facebook still likes me. And you can find me at joeclifford.com, www.joeclifford.com. And I'm not saying I've Googled myself, but if I had been that desperate, lame, and lonely and Googled myself, I could tell you I am the number one Joe Clifford on Google. So I'm very easy to find. And drop me a line, say hello, or tell me how much you are disappointed.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we'll see if we can get you banned from Facebook.
Just a matter of time.
I'll just start reporting every post. Saying it just depends.
Yeah, it won't take one. For
I broke my pearls.
I seem to be safely, you know, ensconced over there. But who knows? Yeah. You know, I'll do something eventually.
So you're writing that many, 4 books a year. So, wow, you're doing pretty quick. You must be working on your next one already then.
It's less that I write quick and more that all I do is write. I have this bone thing from the motorcycle accident. And when my bones are working, I play golf, but that's 2 minutes down the road. Otherwise I'm in front of this computer, you know, nonstop. It's, you know, I control, you know, this is a hubristic element to being a writer. I mean, let's face it. You're a god and you're making a world in which you can't be hurt. There's a psychology that goes on there, right? Like you are in charge. You decide who lives. You decide who dies. You know, your brother doesn't have to die. You know, my next book's about my brother. He's dead, but in my book, I bring him back because I can do that. I wouldn't recommend writing a book like a dead brother. Yeah, I mean, I write a lot. I was given a second chance after they picked me up off the street in the state of California, wiped my record clean and said, hey, here's your second chance. And I believe the least I owe is to make the most of that second chance and to work and to keep working and to produce as many quality books as I can. And if I can, you know, speak to one or two people and it makes a difference in their life, that's what matters. I get a lot of letters from prison. My biggest readership seems to be prison, my book Junkie Love, but I'll get a lot of letters from ex-cons or current cons and who say, you know, hey, you know, Junkie Love's been passed around, you know, the prison and it really changed my life. And that to me is worth more than all the money or a big five publishing or big four. And that's not hyperbole. It really is true.
Well, you write standalone novels, you write series. Do you like one better? And do you find that it's easier to, you know, sell or market?
I love Dennis Lehane's line about this. He says, why you stopped writing series. He's like, because nobody ever says the 17th book in a series was my favorite. I prefer standalones. Even the Jay Porter thriller series, which is 5 books, is really just 1 book split into 5 parts. I have a hard time with here's the same story, and here's the character, and now he's coming to town, here's his problem, he's going to do the same thing, he does everything, and here's the same arc. And others, you know, there's comfort and familiarity, and that's cool. And There's guys who do this and there's guys who are better than anybody. James Patterson's a god at this and this, he's a wonderful human being for all the help he's given, especially in indie bookstores. But I can't do that stuff. I just can't. It's not what I do. So, standalones or, if not standalones, at least in the same sort of universe. I mean, all the books sort of exist in the same universe. I'll frequently bring back minor characters that nobody will notice, just to entertain myself. But, yeah, it's one big, you know, Joe Clifford world. And if you want to see what that's like, you know, step inside and then take a shower.
Oh, all right. I like taking showers. Hey, listen, so who have you killed off in the book? Like, of real life? Come on. There's like someone in your life.
You want real life? Okay, I got to go pick up my kids. This will be the last story I tell you.
Yeah.
Paul Manafort, the Paul Manafort you know of as, you know, the Paul Manafort. My father worked for that guy. My brother married a cousin. Paul Manafort, it's a made up family name. There's only like five Manaforts. They literally, when I say literally, I mean literally, killed my dad. They sent him out to one of the brothers worked at a construction site. They knew the job site was contaminated. They decided that it was cheaper to pay the wrongful death suit to my stepmother, who then surprisingly fled town with millions and never talked to us again. And they killed the man. So Jay Porter books are all about my dad and my brother and that. And the last two books, the last book in the Say My Name that's coming out, in the Say My Name novel, I won't say a word, just spells us out plain as day. Paul Manafort, Frank Manafort, your sons of bitches and your assholes. And I know I get bleeped, but they're two of the worst people face the earth. And I gladly kill them in one way or the other.
Well, there we have it. What can I say?
Yeah,
we're always leaving on a happy end. So now the book.
I'm going to golf ball.
All right. All Who Wonder. And the author's our guest, Joe Clifford. Thank you for being here.
All right. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks, Joe.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.